Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Wednesday morning, the 3rd of April. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m. This is Michael Reid on LMFM. Sinn Féin continues to call for a general election, but it's a call that's falling on deaf ears. The government says the people of this country do not want a general election. Simon Harris has become the new leader of Fine Gael. Next week he'll become Taoiseach and he will form the next government with Fianna Fáil and the Greens. It is all but inevitable. Let's speak to Sinn Féin spokesperson on finance, Piers Doherty, who joins us on the line. Good morning to you, Piers Doherty. Thanks for your time. Can you explain to us why it is you continue to call for a general election when the government has made it clear it has the numbers and it is determined to fulfil its mandate and see out its full term?
Well, let's be clear. First of all, the government themselves within their own parliamentary parties do not have a majority in the Dáil. They are in office today, and if Simon Harris is to be elected Taoiseach, it will be with those outside of their parliamentary parties. We know that independents have kept this government in office, and it's yet to be seen whether independents will continue to provide cover for Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party. And Michael, what we say very clearly is, look, you know, if Simon Harris or indeed Micheál Martin or Eamon Ryan is so convinced of what they believe is the good job that they're doing, of how they're handling the housing crisis, how they're handling the health crisis, how they think that, you know, it's right to put up the price of petrol and diesel as they did on Monday and plan to do it two times again before the end of the year, then let the people decide. Let the people have their say, because we're in uncharted territories here. Never has there been a situation in 4 years where we would have three different Taoiseach. It's just, you know, it's at a point of ridiculousness now. And, you know, as we say, we have nothing to fear by allowing the people to have their say. Let them decide who they want to be in government.
But that's what the people do, isn't it? Every 5 years. It must happen every 5 years at a minimum, and there must be a general election by March of next year.
There must be, and there can be a general election in any other period in between, particularly when you have instability within a government or when a government believes that it doesn't have a mandate. And I would argue very strongly that the proposed incoming Taoiseach does not have a mandate, never presented himself as leader of the party, nobody that went to the ballot box thought that they would be voting Simon Harris as Taoiseach. Like, remember, this party came third in the general election and Simon Harris wasn't even presenting himself as the leader. You know, so the option here is to go for an election, as I said. That's what would happen. I actually recall back, Michael, when in 2010, remember when we had that farce with Fianna Fáil and the Green Party, just as the IMF were coming to town and they had a cabinet reshuffle and half the ministers wouldn't stand, and we had ministers with three and four portfolios. At that time, Leo Varadkar stood up in the Dáil and talked about that, you know, they needed to go to the country and get a mandate for the next 5 years. Of course, the Fianna Fáil government at that time constitutionally was completely within its rights to do what it was doing. But from a point of view in terms of, did it have a mandate to do what it was doing? Did it have the will of the people? It didn't. And Leo Varadkar was right that time, just as we're right now. And that the government should dissolve. They should go to the people. And look, if the people decide that they want Simon Harris to lead them in the next election, then so be it. But I believe we should have that discussion now. I think that people should have their say. And it's very clear that Fine Gael are running scared of the electorate.
Are you sure about that, that you want to have this conversation? Because the last time you raised this in the Dáil with the Taoiseach Micheál Martin said Sinn Féin does not have substance and it does not have detail. It has bluster, bluster and bluster. And he said the party is not ready for a general election.
Yeah, I think that's the discussion when I actually reminded him that I took him and his cabinet colleagues to the High Court in 2010 because they breached the constitutional rights of every single person, every elector in Donegal. It was at a time when that Fianna Fáil government that I just referred to refused to hold a by-election, even though that there was a vacancy for a year and a half. And I had to take him and all his cabinet colleagues to the High Court, and the High Court found them guilty of breaching the constitutional rights of people in Donegal. So I reminded them that I would take no lectures from him in democracy, given that the courts decided who actually was in breach of the most fundamental democratic right, and that is the right to choose your representatives. But look, you know, Micheál Martin can say whatever he wants to say. Political opponents will say whatever he wants to say. You'll have all of this kind of stuff thrown across the Dáil chamber. Let the people decide. Let the people decide who's full of bluff and bluster. Mm. Let the people decide who they want to lead them. Because, like, we've seen it in all the polls. Fianna Fáil are tanking in the polls compared to where they were in the general election. So, as I said,
there's a slump for Sinn Féin. Are you concerned about that downward slide?
And we're slumping to first place in all of the polls. So it's probably a decent place to be in, Michael. Obviously, we take absolutely nothing for granted.
You were first place in the last general election, though, weren't you? And forced into opposition.
We were about a point, a difference between us and the other political parties. I think at the minute we're about 8-9 points difference. But look, as I was saying, is polls are polls. When we go out and fight an election, it's no different from the local and European elections. Nobody has a vote. Every single vote has to be won, has to be earned, and every person who gives you their vote gives you their trust, not just their vote. So, like, we take absolutely nothing for granted. We know the campaign can go different ways. We went into the last election campaign on 15%. We ended up on 25% because people seen the leadership of Mary Lou McDonald. People heard the vision of Sinn Féin, and people rallied to that. And I believe that we will do the same thing again, but I don't take it for granted. But as I said, I'm not afraid of the electorate. That's the difference between Fine Gael and
the electorate. The electorate have been confused, have they not, by Sinn Féin in recent times? They've been confused by what is said to be conflicting messages on immigration. They've been confused by Sinn Féin's position on the TV licence. They've been confused by a call for Helen McEntee to resign after the riots in Dublin. They're not sure that if they understand what Sinn Féin stands for today, that it will stand for the same thing tomorrow, in other words.
Well, we can go through those in each of them, because I don't agree with the point that you're putting, but let me go through these in each. And let's remember, you know, as I said, the polls are the best indication of where they're at, and Sinn Féin in every single poll are way above our rivals and well above where we were in terms of the general election. But first of all, we don't have confidence in Helen McEntee, but neither do we have confidence in any of our government. So there's no confusion. I don't think anybody out there thinks that Sinn Féin is actually rallying to the calls of either the housing minister or the health minister or the justice minister. So that's very, very clear. So there's no confusion in relation to that. We didn't stand up one day and say we're for her and then the other day against her. In relation to the TV licence, we're very, very clear in that again. Mary Lou outlined our position, I think, back in September to the media, that we believe that it should be publicly funded the same way that the expert commission that were set up by this government that reported over 3 years ago said that you need to get rid of the TV license, that it's a failing method. It's happening right across Europe where people are moving away from the TV license. We now have close to 30% of people who aren't paying the TV license in the first instance, and therefore what it needs to be happen is it needs to be funded by direct exchequer. the government have a different view. They're going to go against the expert advice and they're going to take in another charge is what we believe is going to happen. And we will fight them tooth and nail in relation to that. But that's their position. That's very clear. It's consistent with the advice from the expert commission, and we'll continue to argue that case. In relation to immigration, again, we have different views in relation to the government in terms of immigration. You would have heard some of our spokesperson talk about the D Hotel, for example. You would have heard how we believe that the system that we have needs to be fair, it needs to be efficient, and it needs to be enforced. And what does that mean? It means that, you know, that there should be no benefit to anybody above anybody else who are coming here for international protection. Those who are coming here for international protection need to be processed in a speedy way, and they need to be dealt with humanely. But those who then have their applications rejected and have their appeals rejected, then we need to have a system that is enforced. And we don't have a system that is enforced at the minute. And you would have, I'm sure,
you're echoing government policy, which has also changed ahead of elections. And you would cut the welfare rates for Ukrainians, would you not?
We would. And we argued, actually, that the government has made a mistake by what they're doing. So let me explain what they're doing. There is a reduction in terms of the supports for Ukrainians, for people who come to the state from now on. But the problem is that the government have assigned that only to where they're living. So if they're in a designated centre, the social welfare rates are reduced. But if they're not in a designated centre, their social welfare rates go back up from €37 up to €232. The problem here, Michael, is for the first time ever, now we have an incentive, even though it's a bad incentive and it's not a huge amount of money, there is now an incentive where somebody is getting €37 per week in a centre, and now they know that they can get €232 if they go out and find a private rental home. And we also know that the government, which we voted against, the government are going to continue with the scheme that was supposed to end, where the government will pay €800 tax-free to that family to actually rent a house. The problem here is that now you have a situation for the first time where there's a built-in incentive for Ukrainians who are coming here to actually compete in the private rental market, where they will actually get increased social welfare compared to the low rates that they're now on. They will get increased social welfare as a result of that, and the state, through the accommodation scheme, will provide the rent for that house. And that's not fair. I talked about the three principles. Fairness has to be at the core of it. So I'm dealing with a family, to give you an example, in West Donegal. That family, is landlord is selling up, right, because of the pricing of houses in the market. That family is becoming homeless. We can't find accommodation for them. We've gone to people who have holiday homes. We're asking people and all the rest. If there is a rental accommodation here, the average rent in Donegal is in the region of €900. It's one of the lowest in the country. But the landlord who's renting that property can rent it to that family, to that Donegal family, for €900, or they can provide it to through the Ukrainian scheme, and they can get €800 tax-free. Now, that is the equivalent of €1,600 before tax. And many of the Ukrainian families, as we see in terms of the advertisements that are up in the shops, they are saying that they will pay a couple of €100 extra. And that's a problem. Like, that is a problem, because that's not fair. So when somebody comes to my constituency office and says, is that fair? It is not fair. So we need fair, we need efficient, and we need enforced. Do those families need to be supported, the Ukrainian family that are fleeing war and persecution? Absolutely, without a doubt. But it needs to be not at the disadvantage of anybody else. It needs to be fair across the board.
Let me conclude about asking about fuel prices. You mentioned that the government has put the price of petrol and diesel up. The government says quite the opposite. In fact, they've saved motorists over €1 billion because they reduced excise duties. And on Monday, as scheduled, as planned, as promised, they restored those excise duties.
Well, let's be clear. On Monday, the price of petrol and diesel went up. And the government aren't finished there. They are going to put the price of petrol and diesel up again on the 1st of August. And they're going to put it up again for the third time this year on the 9th of October. Petrol and diesel is now 30% more than it was 3 years ago. And see, in terms of border counties like my own and where your listeners are, petrol will be actually 20 cents cheaper, over 20 cents cheaper in the north compared it is to the south. So this isn't just an issue in terms of cost of living pressures on families, which is the key issue for me, but it is also about the future of businesses, the viabilities of small border shops with petrol pumps on them because of the differential in price. And sometimes government have to do things, and sometimes, you know, maybe it's going to put additional pressure on families, but this is not one of the things that they have to do. We're going to record, we're on course to record surpluses of 11 billion euro. We do not need this revenue at this point in time. We do not need to be putting additional pressure on motorists by jacking up prices on petrol and diesel on three occasions this year. We are in the middle of a cost of living crisis. And what a government who is in touch with the concerns of ordinary people should be doing is about reducing the burden, not heaping additional burden on. So you'll probably have people from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the Greens, maybe even independents who are keeping this government in office, and they'll talk about how they understand that people are feeling the pinch during the cost of living crisis. That's nonsense, because they are deciding to put up one of the basic prices on people, which is the cost of getting from A to B, going to work, dropping your kids off to school, or going to the hospital. And it's not acceptable. And they plan to do it three times this year.
All right. I've run over time, but just before we say good morning to you, can I ask you as briefly as possible, will Sinn Féin be nominating Mary Lou MacDonald to become the next Taoiseach when the Dáil resumes next week?
No, what we're saying is this farce needs to end. We don't need three Taoiseachs in 4 years. What we need is a general election. We need to allow the people to have their say and let them have their say, who they believe should be the next government and the next Taoiseach.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you indeed for joining us this morning. Piers Doherty is Sinn Féin spokesperson on finance. Now, the Irish Medical Organisations AGM gets underway in Killarney tomorrow. One of the major issues of concern is the long hours that doctors are working in hospitals. A survey of non-consultant hospital doctors, or NCHDs, also known as junior doctors, says that they are routinely working unsafe and illegal hours. Dr. Brian O'Mahony is a member of the NCHD Committee of the IMO and joins us now. And a very good morning to you, Dr. O'Mahony, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. 100% of the junior doctors surveyed said that their working conditions and a lack of support is fueling the shortage of doctors in hospitals by driving many of those who are in that position overseas for work. It obviously is a dire situation, but it's not a new situation. How has this been continuing for close on 40 years at this stage?
Good morning, Michael, and thanks for having me on, and thanks for spreading the word for the survey. There is a continually increasing exodus of doctors to Australia, New Zealand in particular. So it would have been, as you said, it's been occurring for a long time, but just in my own time as a doctor in my class, maybe 2 years above me, there would have been maybe 10% of the class would have left for Australia and New Zealand. I think recently in Cork, where I'm from, close to 100% of the undergraduate doctors would have moved to Australia and New Zealand. So it's becoming much more a problem. And yes, they do. Some of them do come back, but a lot of them are staying over there as well. So a lot of the funds that are being put into doctors training in Ireland are being lost because the working conditions here are making people stay in Australia and New Zealand and not coming back. And then obviously there's the other effect of the lack of doctors in Ireland contributing to this unsatisfactory working conditions, which the survey just talks about.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about long working hours, we're talking about working in a way that is not legal. It's in breach of the Working Time Act, and 83% of NCHDs say that that's happening routinely. How many hours a week are doctors working?
So that's over 48 hours a week for 2 hours for 2 weeks in a row. So it is a significant amount of hours, and also would comprise of people working 24-hour shifts, which I know when I speak to friends of mine who aren't doctors, they just can't believe that 24-hour shifts are still ongoing. People, you know, they're providing emergency care oftentimes 23 hours into a shift, so without any sleep at all, which isn't a situation patients want to be in if you're being treated by a doctor who's sleep deprived. The doctors, of course, are doing their best, but there's only so much you can do when fatigue is at that level. And obviously your mental activity would be worsens when you're in such a state.
And this is anything but trivial. This is anything but trivial work. If somebody is in hospital at the moment and they see a doctor, most likely the doctor they see will be an NCHD.
Yes, especially after hours. So the consultants would tend to be on call from home, so they would take calls from the anesthesiologist. But if you're in hospital from 5 p.m. onwards, you're dealing with just your doctors, oftentimes just interns who are people who are just out of college, if you're in an inpatient in the hospital. So, and again, they are doing very rest, and they're very capable doctors. Mm. But when you're so sleep deprived, your performance takes a hit. And as you said, these are oftentimes people are undergoing surgery at nighttime, or having acute medical issues in the hospital. So it's just not ideal at all.
How do you think, let alone make important medical decisions, if you're working 24 hours?
I suppose a lot of it is instinct. You do, like, obviously you retain some capacity and you do kind of get used to it at a certain point, but obviously you're nowhere near to the level you want to be. And it is very hard to be at your best. And it's also just very unhealthy for people. I've no doubt it contributes to sleep issues among doctors and long-term cardiovascular issues as well. People drink a lot of coffee, obviously, as well, as a big one.
Right, which isn't very healthy either, I'm sure. Not sleeping like that isn't healthy. It's almost ironic. But a task force has been looking at this. And in February, it launched its report and made 44 recommendations. The minister has said it's his priority to implement these recommendations. Does that make... you feel more reassured?
I would hope so. I'd hope that would lead to some progress. I think the results of the survey would show that progress isn't really happening as fast as we'd like it to. There's been a recruitment freeze recently as well in the HSE, which your listeners might have heard of, which it means pretty much that the government will very struggle to implement the changes, because one of the changes recommended is that the NCHD workforce needs to increase by quite a bit. So if there's a recruitment freeze, obviously that won't happen. And I don't really see how the issues that are presented in the survey would be changed unless there's an increase in junior doctors on the ground. And that would stop people from having to work extra shifts, hopefully stop having people do 24-hour calls. A big problem would be people getting... as the survey said, people being forced into work extra shifts, often at short notice, which is obviously not very good for your quality of life either. So, people often with families, they're coming out of college. A lot of the graduate entry people who've done a degree previously might have a lot of debt to pay off, and working extra hours being taken away from your family, often for a week of nights. You don't see your family at all, really. So, they're tough working conditions at the moment.
Mm. It's a chicken and egg situation, though, isn't it? you need more doctors so that you don't have to work the hours, but doctors are leaving because of the hours that are being worked, which leads to a shortage of doctors.
And I suppose the easy fix to that in IMO's mind would be to improve working conditions so that people aren't leaving as much. That would have a lot of effects, and also increase working satisfaction amongst junior doctors as well.
I'm sure there was a vote that would have supported industrial action that went off the agenda. You're obviously going to make this a major issue as part of the IMO conference. What next? Will you be looking at this task force report and its recommendations and the speed of implementation, or what's the approach?
Yeah, so obviously the recommendations were very welcome. There was a vote in the IMO and it was close to 100% approval rate for accepting those terms to avoid industrial action. So we would just look to see if that could be implemented. Obviously, things change quite quickly, and the recruitment freeze isn't ideal. So we just need to see how this is going to progress over the next while. But no concrete plans yet, but things might change soon.
Okay, Brian, nice to talk to you. Thank you for joining us on the programme this morning. Dr. Brian O'Mahony is a member of the NCHD Committee of the IMO.
Call Michael now, 041 98 3 2000.
michael@lmfm.ie.
The Michael Reid Show with Airgrid, managing and developing the national electricity grid so that it's fit for our current needs and ready for our future ones.
Thanks to Brendan texting the programme this morning about the state of Dundalk. I think that's a fair way to put it, Brendan. He says it's a disgrace. Here we are into spring, and what about the state of the streets? They're rotten, dirty. Take a look around the estates. And he wonders why we can't use school kids who are on their Easter break to sweep the streets, get them out of their bedrooms, away from social media, and do something in the community. Their guardians and parents are members of residence committees, and he says, yes, kick them out of their bedroom and let them clean up our town's streets when they're on holidays. Thanks, Brendan. It's an interesting text. I'm not sure how many people would agree with that. But there certainly seems to be something that needs to be done about social media. The point, one of the points that you made, to get them out of their bedrooms, away from social media. And it's at all ages, isn't it? Pretty shocking news this week with the Minister for Education, Norma Foley, speaking at the Irish Teachers Organisation's annual Congress in Derry about the sharp rise in self-generated comprising images of a sexual nature among 7 to 10-year-olds. It's stark. It's stark to think that the minister has said that she's concerned about it, and that her concerns have come from a briefing that she's got from the online regulator, Commissioner Naman, who are monitoring this. She says it's very difficult. It's up to parents, I suppose, but it's very difficult to do anything about children using the internet, because a lot of these social media apps have the minimum age of 13. Of course, though, you can put any age in when you're signing up, and it doesn't need to be verified. And one of the things that she's been talking about is friendship streaks, where you have a flame icon showing the number of days that you're in contact with your best friend. If you don't do it tomorrow, well, then that flame icon will not light up. So you have to do it tomorrow. So you're addicted. And that's part of these approaches or algorithms or whatever that social media companies are using to keep people online, to keep them interested, or more probably to the point, in a way that they can't look away and spend so much time on social media. Thanks, Brendan, for your comment. Another comment comes to us from a listener about the 2022 expenses of county councillors in County Louth, which has just been made public. Eye-watering amounts of money claimed. In particular, P.O. Smith over €55,000. This is something that you might have seen in the local newspapers this week. Pretty huge amount of money, and there is no doubt about it. Over €1 million claimed in expenses by councillors last year. P.O. Smith, who was mentioned there, €55,296.06 in expenses. There's James Byrne with over €43,000 in expenses. Joanna Byrne over €41,000 in expenses. Maria Doyle over €43,000 in expenses. Michelle Hall close to €42,000. Connor Keelan close to €43,000. Then Jim Tennessee close to €42,000. Each of the other councillors in excess of €30,000 in expenses. What are they spending money on? What is it that they're incurring these expenses on? It's an awful lot of money, isn't it? Over €1 million anyway, according to the local papers this week. And thanks to our caller for the text in relation to that. Another message comes to us this morning from Deirdre in Kells, who says that I think we're going to have to get robot doctors that can work 24 hours a day, computer doctors that can do all of the work. We have to keep the junior doctors in Ireland, pay them well to stay in this country. The hospitals need them very badly. Thanks for your message to the programme as always, Deirdre. Thanks to James, who's in RD, who's been in touch with us to say that he is totally aghast every time and without fail that he turns on his television to see what is happening in Gaza and now beyond with an attack on Damascus and how that could escalate this war with Iran now saying that it is going to retaliate. This is something that we'll be talking about in the second hour of the programme, James. Thanks for your call. Quite horrific to see humanitarian aid workers targeted yesterday, especially when they gave the Israelis prior notice of what their movements would be, and the Israelis somehow ended up attacking them, bombing them, and saying these things happen in a war situation. And of course, there's the destruction of that hospital yesterday. It's, to all intents and purposes, a thing of the past and no longer a medical facility in the part of the world that needs a medical facility more than any other part of the world. As I say, James, thanks for your message. If you'd like to make a comment on our programme today, as always, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 0419832000. That's if you want to ring us today and make a comment on the programme, 0419832000. Our text number, if you want to send a message to us, is 086 1800 658. You can also send your message by WhatsApp to the same number. That's 086 1800 658. And if you'd like to make comment by email, please do so. We'd love to hear from you. michael@lmfm.ie.
2000.
The Michael Reid Show, brought to you by Airgrid, managing and planning the national grid so that everyone has electricity when and where they need it.
Now, you heard Brendan suggest that school kids should be taken out of their bedrooms, away from social media, and forced, if you like, to clean up the streets over the course of the Easter break. An avid listener in touch with us saying that there's plenty of able-bodied people who are on social welfare. Why can't they be made clean up litter, etc., and earn the money that they get in welfare? Snowflakes, too lazy to work, the lot of them, says the Navin listener in that text message. Thank you for your message to the programme, 086 1800 658. Now, as mentioned earlier on, we will turn our attention to what is happening in the Middle East. Let's begin with the destruction of the Al-Shifa hospital, something that cannot be understated in terms of how important this hospital was to people at a time of war, at a time of great need. This is what Dr. Margaret Harris, WHO spokesperson, had to say about it.
The directors told us that Al-Shifa Hospital is gone, that it's no longer able to function in any shape or form as a hospital. We know that at least 21 patients died during the period of the siege. We also know that the staff had to bring the patients together in a building that wasn't even a clinical building. It was a human resources administration area. They had no water, food. They were sharing one bottle of water between 15 people.
Israel says Hamas was using the hospital as a headquarters and using the patients as human shields. But the WHO says that the destruction of this hospital will have a devastating effect.
Destroying Al-Shifa means ripping the heart out of the health system. It was the tertiary care centre. It was a huge hospital, 750 beds, 25 operating theatres, 30 intensive care rooms. You know, it was the place people go to for the kind of care that a really good health system provides.
Obviously not anymore, because the hospital is no longer and will no longer be available. That's one of the issues of concern over the last 24 hours. Then there is the attack on those humanitarian aid workers, seven of whom died working for the World Central Kitchen.
First, I can only say that for so many of us, we extend our condolences to the loved ones, to the families, the friends, the colleagues of those who lost their lives, as well as those who were injured. I spoke to Jose Andres just about a week ago about the efforts that World Central Kitchen is engaged in Gaza, as it is in many other conflict zones around the world, including in Ukraine. They have been doing extraordinary, brave work, day in, day out, and critical work to try to make sure that people in need get what they need, starting with the most basic thing of all, food to survive. The victims of yesterday's strike join a record number of humanitarian workers who've been killed in this particular conflict. These people are heroes. They run into the fire, not away from it. They show the best of what humanity has to offer when the going really gets tough. They have to be protected. We shouldn't have a situation where people who are simply trying to help their fellow human beings are themselves at grave risk. We've spoken directly to the Israeli government about this particular incident. We've urged a swift, a thorough, an impartial investigation to understand exactly what happened. And as we have throughout this conflict, we've impressed upon the Israelis the absolute imperative of doing more to protect innocent civilian lives, be they Palestinian children, women, and men, or be they aid workers, as well as to get more humanitarian assistance to more people more effectively. Finally, let me just say that
strong words from Anthony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, and unequivocal condemnation from Israel's best friend. Let's hear what the Secretary General of the United Nations had to say about it.
The devastating Israeli airstrikes that killed World Central Kitchen personnel yesterday bring the number of aid workers killed in this conflict to 196, including more than 175 members of our own UN staff. This is unconscionable, but it is an inevitable result of the way the war is being conducted. It demonstrates yet again the urgent need for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, and the expansion of humanitarian aid into Gaza, as the Security Council demanded in its resolution last week. The resolution must be implemented without delay.
That resolution called for that immediate humanitarian ceasefire, but it appears that that call is falling on deaf Israeli ears.
This was an agreed mission with this team. It was deconflicted. Deconflicted means both sides know they're coming, both sides have agreed. The car was well marked. It was very clear it was World Central Kitchen. Now, this is happening, and remember, hundreds of healthcare workers have been killed while doing their job, ambulance drivers, and of course, thousands of civilians, more than 13,000 of them children.
It's hard to think that there's any argument at this stage which would prevent a ceasefire from taking place in Gaza now.
The ceasefire, the UN resolution, the world has agreed a ceasefire must happen. It should have happened months ago, but it must happen now.
Margaret Harris, once again, of the World the World Health Organization. So let's go from that to the destruction, as we've been hearing, of a major hospital to an atrocious attack on an aid convoy and the killing of seven people delivering humanitarian aid. There's also been widespread condemnation of Israel's actions in Syria yesterday.
And I can tell you that the Secretary General condemns the attack on diplomatic premises of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Damascus, as well as the reported casualties. He reaffirms that the principle of inviolability of diplomatic and consular premises and personnel must be respected in all cases in accordance with international law. Mr. Guterres also reminds all parties to respect all of their obligations under international law, including international humanitarian law as applicable. Secretary General also repeats his call on all concerned to avoid attacks that could harm civilians and damage civilian infrastructure. He further calls on all concerned to exercise the utmost restraint and avoid any further escalation. He cautions that any miscalculation could lead to a broader conflict in an already volatile region with devastating consequences for civilians who already are seeing unprecedented suffering in Syria, in Lebanon, the occupied Palestinian territory, and the broader Middle East.
Stephen Jurarik, spokesperson for the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres there, speaking about the Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Seven Iranian military commanders were killed in the attack. Iran says it will retaliate, and the fear now is of an escalation of the war in the Middle East.
Yesterday, the Islamic Republic of Iran transmitted identical letters to the Secretary General and to the Security Council stating that Israel has attacked the location of its diplomatic premises in Damascus by missile strikes, killing at least five Iranian personnel, including senior military advisors, and injuring others. There have been subsequent media reports today that the death toll has risen to 13, seven Iranian personnel and six Syrian citizens. I reiterate the Secretary General's condemnation of the attack. Let me be very clear. The inviolability of diplomatic and consular premises and personnel must be respected.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Respected in all cases in accordance with international law. The sovereignty and territorial integrity of member states must be respected in accordance with international law. The rules-based international order is essential for international peace and security, which this Council is mandated to maintain. Madam President, Special Envoy Geir Pedersen has kept this Council apprised of the unrelenting violence on the ground in Syria, which features six foreign armies operating on its territory, impacting the lives of civilians and moving a peaceful resolution of the conflict farther out of reach. Among them, increasingly lethal attacks on Iran-linked targets in Syria have been attributed to Israel, especially since the current conflict with Hamas in Gaza began on 7th of October. Open sources have reportedly at least a dozen such attacks since the beginning of this year. While Israel has rarely claimed responsibility for any of these incidents, its officials have repeatedly acknowledged its military operations in Syria and have suggested that more such operations will occur in the future. We appeal to the Council today, as we do every month, to continue to actively engage all concerned parties to prevent further escalation and the worsening of tensions that undermine regional peace and security. Madam President, allow me to reiterate the Secretary General's call on all concerned to exercise utmost restraint and avoid further escalation. I also underline his consistent calls on all parties to respect all their obligations under international law, including international humanitarian law, as applicable, and to avoid attacks that could harm civilian and damage civilian infrastructure. Any miscalculation could lead to broader conflict in an already volatile region, with devastating consequences for civilians who are already seeing unprecedented suffering in Syria, Lebanon, the occupied Palestinian territory, and the broader Middle East.
Indeed. A lot of concern, and with a good reason. You've been listening there to Khaled Mohammed Kiari, Assistant Secretary General for the Middle East, Asia and the Pacific with the United Nations. Text about that from a listener who says, Michael, just how low can the Israelis go to defend themselves while the world looks on? Sick people, humanitarian workers, stop all weapons from the USA now, says our caller, as I'm sure many people listening to us do, but the war goes on. A text then about those expenses for councillors in County Louth that we heard about earlier on, all in excess of €30,000, I think, a lot in excess of €40,000, and one in excess of €50,000. Astonishing expenses, says our caller, for councillors that these days have such a limited remit. Some get extra income being chair of this or that or a member of the other. It should all be aggregated for the public to see. Disgraceful too that only a couple of them bothered to make a submission to the Drogheda Joint Local Area Plan. So much for representing the constituents. It's just a gravy train, says our caller. Not pleased at all with how high the expenses claimed are by councillors now. And thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. 0419832000 is always the phone number, text or WhatsApp 0861800658. Email michael@lmfm.ie.
086 1800 658.
The Michael Reid Show, brought to you by Airgrid, managing and planning the national grid so that everyone has electricity when and where they need it.
And I wonder why.
41983 2000.
The Michael Reid Show, brought to you by Airgrid, managing and planning the national grid so that everyone has electricity when and where they need it.
Now, last Thursday, 4.32 million cigarettes with an estimated value of over 3.6 million euro were seized at Dublin Port with the assistance of the detector dog Milo. Revenue officers believe that this would have led to a loss to the Exchequer of over 2.8 million euro. It's an awful lot of money, and it's an awful lot of money to be lost to revenue. That's from the illegal cigarette trade. I don't know if you smoke or if you buy illegal cigarettes, but whether you do smoke or don't smoke, can I ask you if you have purchased illicit products from illicit or unofficial sources? I'll leave you to answer that. But it's a question that 1,500 people were asked under a survey that was carried out by Ireland Thinks. The result is quite incredible. A quarter of us have bought products from the black market in the last year. Benny Gilson, a spokesperson for Retailers Against Smuggling, joins us. Good morning to you, Benny. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. Were you surprised by that finding?
Yes and no, Michael. At the present time, I wouldn't be one bit surprised because I know it and I see it within our own area. I know people who are actually presently going across by ferry twice a week and bringing in approximately 2,000 cigarettes per trip and selling them and making on average €4.50 per pack. People who are buying them off them know that they are duty-free, so they're not what we call or term as the smuggled cigarettes that you don't know what's in them. They are genuine cigarettes that are being brought in duty-free. These people are at it on a daily basis, twice a week. And
they make $4.50 a pack?
$4.50 per packet.
Okay. How is that? Break that down for me, if you would. How much do they buy the packs for themselves?
Well, if we take it if they're buying them duty free, Michael, at as low as a tenner for 200,
right?
You know, they're tenner per packet. They're selling them at €14.50, which is still on average €2 to €2.50 cheaper than the retail outlet,
right?
And if they're selling 2,000, that's given them almost 500 for their two trips.
Mm. So a packet of cigarettes in a shop is what, €16?
Almost €17.
€17 for a packet.
Yeah.
So people are happy to pay €14.50. And this is for a packet that was bought for €10.
Yeah, knowing that they are, what, as I have said, legal, legitimate cigarettes. They're not smuggled. They're brought on duty-free. They're stamped duty-free. And they know that they are legitimate cigarettes.
Is it legal to sell them?
Oh, no, it is not. It's not even legal, Michael, for you or I to go abroad and bring in the legal amount, which is 200. It is not legal for us, for me to hand them over to you, a 200 pack that I'm after buying at a tenner, to charge you a tenner. It's legal for me to hand them over to you and give them to you for nothing, but not for me to actually charge you for them. It's an offence.
Right. I think that'll come as a surprise to a lot of people who over the years brought cigarettes back for somebody, whether they paid them for them or otherwise. It's obviously illegal then to buy them as well.
It is illegal. It is illegal.
Yeah.
It's illegal for the one that sells them anyway.
Yeah.
You know, like you're legally entitled to buy duty-free for your own use.
Mm.
You're not entitled to buy them for... to sell them on to your friends at the price you pay for them.
Mm. It's quite staggering, really, because I'd have thought that, generally speaking, we're a law-abiding nation. Obviously, there's exceptions to every rule, but I would have thought that the majority of people in this country were law-abiding and would pride themselves on that. But a quarter of us, 25% of us, have bought products on the black market. It's not just cigarettes, dodgy boxes, coal and other fuels, drugs, medicines, supplements.
Drugs, medicine, you name it, Michael. They're prepared to buy them. And, you know, when you look at it, like 37% are actually willing, when they were asked, they are willing to buy these products. Like 25% have said they bought them. 37% are willing to buy them, provided the price is cheaper and the product looks the same.
Right. Alcohol is being bought illegally, vaping products, cigarettes and rolling tobacco. And it really is the products related to smoking or nicotine that you're interested in because you believe that's having a very negative impact on the retail trade.
It's having a major impact. You know, we saw again there, Michael, 3 weeks ago, where we had a factory found up in Dublin 9, where they were in the process of ready to start manufacturing. You know, like when you see a seizure of raw tobacco, like you have to say, what's raw tobacco coming in for? It's not coming in to feed cattle. It's coming in like 5-6 ton of it at a time. It has to be coming in for the manufacture of tobacco products.
Mm. How is the internet feeding into all of this?
Well, it is also a factor. But like you know, now with duty free on the ferries, and you can go across to England for such a low price, I think the average price to go across on the ferry for the day trip is from 15.50 to 18 euro, you know, for the day trip. So you go across in the morning, you come back in the evening, and you have your loot. And as I said earlier, you're making on average for the 2,000 lot, which you'll carry in a little hold-all bag on your shoulder. There's no checks, good, bad, or indifferent from what I'm told. So these people are doing it on a twice-weekly trip. We're at the stage now where almost 34% of the overall sale of tobacco product in Ireland is non-duty paid.
Right. You might be giving people ideas. You've sold it pretty well there to listeners. It's very tempting, I'm sure, for people, given how easy it is to make money doing this.
That's quite correct. And, you know, whilst we don't have the resources in revenue or customs to check every individual going out and coming back, then this market is going to grow. You know, we have them tied up, we say, at the main ports where the larger quantities are coming in, and they are seasoned quite an amount. But yes, if we take it that this time last year, for the entire year, 50-odd million was seized for the entire year. To date this year, for 3 months, they have seized over 39 million.
And people are addicted to cigarettes and feel they've no option but to buy them because of their addiction. And that compromises their values, perhaps, and puts them into the black market where they're buying cigarettes cheaper. Is it any different with the vapes? Are people as mad to get cheap vapes no matter where they come from?
Oh, well, of course, Michael. Well, of course. You know, like the vapes, like I wouldn't be 100% sure of what the price of vapes are on the black market. But, you know, vapes are running from 8.50 to a tenner in the retail outlets. You know, if they can buy them on the black market for a fiver, like, they're not questioning where they're coming from. As far as they're concerned, they're not tobacco. They're just saying it's a vape. It's only a vape. It doesn't matter where they're coming from or what's in them. You know, it's like similar to the smuggled cigarettes in the early stages when they were getting them in. It didn't bother them where they were coming from. They were cheaper than the retail cigarette, and it didn't make any difference to them what was in them. They were a cigarette. Now they're beginning to realise that they're not a cigarette, that they're a smuggled product, they're an illegal product, whereas the stuff that's coming in duty-free is a legal, legitimate product.
Jerry Brady texting us, telling us that he thinks that they should be 20 euro a packet, that they'll never be dear enough. I smoked for 50 years, dirty yolks altogether. Price them out of the market is Jerry's approach, but I don't think you agree, Benny.
No. You know, Jerry is talking through his hat. You know, like, price them out of the market for who? He's pricing them out of the market for the legitimate retail outlets. He's not pricing them out of the market for the criminals. You know, that's what I would call anybody who brings them in and sells them. Maybe Jerry himself might do that, bring them in and sell them to make money the same way. You know, price them out of the market for legitimate retailers, like, who are paying their taxes, paying their rates, paying their insurance, paying everything. Yes, he wants to cut them out of business, but he doesn't want to do anything with the people who are bringing them in illegally and selling them without any regard to who they sell them for, sell them to, or what they're doing.
But the price of a packet of cigarettes is made up mostly of taxes, isn't it? At nearly 17 euro, 16.75 a packet of cigarettes now.
But that's 87.9%, Michael.
But that's a public health policy, isn't it? To deter people from smoking, particularly young people from smoking.
Yeah, for the last three budgets, that's what has been announced in the last three budgets when they have increased the price of the packet. This is for health reasons. But yet, as I have said earlier, over 34% of the cigarettes smoked in Ireland today are non-duty paid. So, like, it is a market that's grown. This time last year, I would have said to you that 18% of the cigarettes sold in Ireland were non-duty paid. Now we're up at 34%. That's almost doubled in the space of a year.
Okay, and you believe that makes the argument to reduce the cost of cigarettes?
No, we have never asked the government to reduce the cost of cigarettes. Like we would suggest,
clamp down on the smuggling.
I would suggest that duty free is stopped. If cigarettes are, as they say, as bad as they're making them out to be, then all cigarettes are the same.
Okay,
they're bad for you.
All right, Benny, we leave it there. Thank you for joining us this morning. Benny Gilson, and spokesperson for Retailers Against Smuggling there.
1-800-658.
The Michael Reid Show, brought to you by Airgrid, managing and planning the national grid so that everyone has electricity when and where they need it.
Well, Simon Harris has a job as leader of Fine Gael. Next week he'll have a job as Taoiseach, and with that job comes the job of filling all of the cabinet positions. He has two vacancies as things stand, his own and indeed that of Simon Coveney, who announced yesterday that he will not be able to serve in the next government. Let's speak to Gavin Riley, political correspondent with Virgin Media News and a columnist with the Meath Chronicle. Good morning to you, Gavin, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. A lot of speculation that Minister Coveney moved before he was pushed.
Yeah, and it's easy to see why that view might be out there, because if you just take Leo Varadkar as the example, if Leo Varadkar recognises that Fine Gael is now looking down the barrel of local elections and the national ones soon to follow, and if things are looking a little jaded or a little stale and the party needs an injection of fresh energy, if Leo Varadkar thought that he wasn't fit to inject that because he'd been around for 13 years and he might be seen as yesterday's man, it's very difficult to make any different case for Simon Coveney, because Simon Coveney has been at the cabinet table for every single one of the 13 years that Leo Varadkar has been at the cabinet table. They were appointed on the very same day under Enda Kenny back in 2011, and they have both been there for every single day ever since. So there is certainly an argument that if you wanted to put a new fresh face forward, that Simon Coveney couldn't really be part of the mix. There's also, of course, the personal rationale that if Simon Coveney had already decided that, you know, that he'd already had his go at contesting the party leadership and it wasn't for him and it didn't work out back in 2017, if he wasn't going to go for it again, then realistically, hadn't he climbed every mountain there was going to be? If he didn't want to be Fine Gael leader, if he didn't want to be Taoiseach, then what mountains were there left to climb? If you've been in cabinet for 13 years, if you are this way inclined, if you view it from this sense, he has already worked up the full maximum pension that he's ever going to get. So if you're about to turn 52, you've done this for 26 years, you've got the opportunity to get out and do something different for the next 10 or 15 years of your life, this is the perfect opportunity to do it.
And that is the next question, isn't it? Will he step down as a TD as well as not making himself available to serve in cabinet?
He would certainly serve out the remainder of this Dáil term anyway. But to be honest, I thought it was very curious yesterday, much the same way as Leo Varadkar did. Now that he's acknowledged that he doesn't want to be in cabinet anymore, he was asked, well, do you intend to run in the next election? And just like Leo Varadkar said, he said, oh, I haven't made my mind up about that. It's not a yes and it's not a no. I'll need to talk to people and figure out where my head is at. To be honest, once you have openly entertained some doubts about whether you want the privilege of serving and representing your constituents in Dáil Éireann, to be honest, the ship has sailed. Because no matter how good your record might be in office, if you're turning around to your constituents and say, to be honest, I was thinking about it last year and I wasn't sure if I was bothered looking for your mandate or not, and now here he is looking at the doorsteps, like, it's not going to work out. So as soon as you've started entertaining any doubts about whether you want to run for Dáil Éireann or not, once you've entertained those doubts, that's it, you are gone. So I don't expect him to be running again next time around. I mean, there were already some indications that he might have been so minded anyway. He has moved the family home in recent years. He's now not living in the same areas of Ballincollig where he was previously. He's moved the family to Cove, which would mean he would now be living in the Cork East constituency and notionally trying to represent a constituency that he doesn't live in anymore. Like, it's not a cardinal sin. It's been done before. But I thought that was a bit of an illustration that maybe Simon Coveney was now beginning to look elsewhere. To be honest, like, much as it's... He sort of feels like he's been a lifer and that he's been in cabinet for 13 years. He is only turning 52 this month. Like, he's been in Dáil Éireann since he was 26, 5 years in the European Parliament in between. But he's been there for a long old time. And he still has he's, or at least he claims to have, some gas left in the tank to go and do something else. So to be honest, I think if you were ever looking for an out, I think now would be the time. And I have heard some rumours that there's a few multinationals that have already put offers on the table that whenever Simon Coveney is out of politics, that they'd be more than happy to have him on their own payrolls.
Okay, but politically, it's hard to keep count of how many TDs may not run when we get to the next general election for Fine Gael. What's your sense of it at this stage? More than 10, but how much more?
Yeah, well, so it's officially 10 of the 33, or is I think it's 34, 33 or 34 that are in the parliamentary party right now. 33 TDs, I think there are within the Fine Gael parliamentary party right now. And 10 of them have already decided they're not running. Joe McHugh is not technically within the parliamentary party, but he's already decided he's not running. I think that would make it number 11. If you include Owen Murphy, who has already resigned out of this stall after deciding he wasn't up for it anymore, that would make 12. Simon Coveney, presuming he doesn't go, because I genuinely don't think he will be number 13. Leo Varadkar himself, presuming he doesn't want to run again because he's climbed every mountain that there is to climb, he would probably be number 14. So that's 14 out of 35 Fine Gael TDs elected last time around not running. I mean, that presents a huge electoral challenge. Some of them are in constituencies where there are ready-made successors who might be there. You know, for example, if Simon Coveney, very easy to understand that Jerry Buttermer, who was previously represented that same constituency in the Dáil, very easy to think that he would run and comfortably retain that Fine Gael seat, providing, of course, he isn't giving a running mate that could split the vote. So there's a few cases where it's relatively okay, but there's a few other cases in which, you know, the lack of an obvious successor is a bit of a challenge. You know, if you look at Leo Varadkar's own constituency of Dublin West, he has had various running mates put with him over the years, none of whom have ever come anywhere close to troubling the idea of getting elected to Dáil Éireann. I mean, Leo Varadkar himself, he had to wait until the fifth count before he finally made it over the line last time, couldn't get a quota by himself. So, you know, Fine Gael trying to retain that seat without the personality, the tried and tested personality of Leo Varadkar there, will be a challenge. And that is almost certainly going to be party challenge number one for Simon Harris now that he has officially taken over as party leader. Where is he going to find the candidates that can comfortably try to retain those seats? And that's why it makes a lot of sense for Leo Varadkar to have gotten off the pitch now, because it gives Simon Harris at least 3 months to figure out his plans for the local elections, because that really is the key to finding out which candidates might have a chance of keeping the Dáil seats.
Yeah, you'd wonder, is he wise to take it on? Because we are talking about an exodus en masse, which quite often prompts people to say it's like rats on a sinking ship. The leadership at this stage looks like a poison chalice.
Which is funny if you think of it that way, because, like, after all, it's leadership that comes with the office of Taoiseach, at least for 12 months. So, like, as poison chalices go, it's a pretty unusual one where you get to run a country for 12 months before things might start to go a little bit south. And I suppose one thing is that no matter what other people might think in Fine Gael, I do get the impression from Simon Harris, at least with this new injection of initiative that's come after the change of leadership in the last couple of weeks, that he hasn't exactly resigned himself to the idea of only leading for 12 months and then going. That he sees the direction of the opinion polls, the slight softening in Sinn Féin support, the slight resurgence in support for the government parties. He and those close to him are genuinely making the case that if the government has a good budget that is well received by the people, you could knock another couple of percentage points off that. Throw in the bounce that you might get from the presentation of a new leader anyway, the general bounce that parties tend to get after changing personnel at the top. And suddenly that it's game on. And he doesn't think it's impossible that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, whether it's with the Greens or some other party like the Social Democrats or maybe Labour, depending on how well they do, he basically hasn't ruled out the idea that there might be enough seats in the next Dáil for the present government to, by and large, remain as it is. Now, it's certainly a very uphill challenge, because there are definitely many within the party who do think that they're institutionally jaded, who just don't think it's plausible that after 14 years in government that the public would give you another 5-year term, that everyone has an appetite for change at some point. But yeah, it's Simon Harris, I don't think he's ruled it out. And if at the very least, yes, it is, if it does become a poison chalice, if he has a mediocre local elections and a mediocre general election next springtime, and he finds himself casted to the opposition benches for a couple of years, it's the poison chalice that comes with getting to be Taoiseach for 12 months, which only 14 mm-hmm. people in the history of the state have ever been able to do. So as hospital passes go, it's not the worst one.
All right, Neil, have to select his team. All eyes on the next cabinet. What's your thoughts on that? How will Simon Harris go about filling those vacancies? And will there be other changes for that matter?
Well, the job is definitely made easier by Simon Coveney not being there anymore, because when you think that Simon Harris only has six Fine Gael seats at cabinet and one of them is his own, if he does want to try and present this new sort of energised front, if he was only changing one personality at the top level a year out from a general election, they would look very jaded by the time you got to the other election. Now, as it stands, when they go to the polls next springtime, the most longest serving ministers will be Pascal Donoghue and Heather Humphreys, who'll both be there for 10 and a half, closing on 11 years. Simon Harris himself will have been in cabinet for 9 years and Helen McAtee will have been there for five. Anyone else is new and will only have been there for 12 months at maximum. There seems to be this expectation, to be fair, others appear to be better briefed than this than I do, but there appears to be some expectation among some others that Peter Burke, who is at present the junior minister for European Affairs, who has been flanking Leo Varadkar at all the European summits, who has the same junior ministerial job that Helen McEntee used to have, that he is now destined for one of the two cabinet jobs that's becoming vacant because of Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney moving on. And if that is true, Simon Harris is to some degree giving himself a big challenge, because that means that with the departure of Simon Coveney, granted there are two other Fianna Fáil ministers at cabinet from that same constituency in Cork South Central, but from a Fine Gael perspective, there would basically be very few people along the West Coast and anywhere in Munster at the cabinet table. So you're looking at a situation where maybe the current chief whip, Hildegard Nocton, were she to be promoted, you at least would have another female representative and you'd have somebody from the West, but you would have no Fine Gael cabinet ministers from Munster. So what else do you do? Well, some of the other options you have are Kieran O'Donnell and Patrick O'Donovan, both junior ministers at the Departments of Housing and in Finance. Patrick O'Donovan is a prospective senior minister. He would certainly be well respected enough within the party. It is worth noting that Patrick O'Donovan was once reported to have operated a sting operation to see whether Simon Harris was leaking material out of cabinet, and made a lot of hay out of the fact that he was the one who had apparently identified Simon Harris as being something of a cabinet squeal. So the idea that Simon Harris right. would now appoint Patrick O'Donovan to the same cabinet would be fascinating. And then, of course, there is the thing that, you know, is Fine Gael happy to have no Cork representatives of its own? Would it feel that it was punished by going into the next election without any cabinet representatives of its own in the second city? That might be good news for the likes of Colin Burke, a longtime Fine Gael stalwart who's only in his first term as a TD after 40 years of looking. Might he get a ministerial promotion of some sort, or might he have to contend with something on the junior ministerial ranks? Ironically enough, and I know I've been going on about this for a while now, but ironically enough, of the 33 TDs, assuming that you rule out the 10 that are retiring and Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney, you are left with only 21 TDs to whom you can give jobs anyway, and there are only 14 jobs to give. So you find yourself very quickly almost running out of candidates. And if you do want to reach that geographical spread, even further, fewer options. I mean, a lot of people think that Alan Dillon, who's currently the chairman of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party, first term TD for Mayo, of course, former member of their Gaelic football team, he might get at least a very junior ministry. And that might mean that there's another representation on the west coast of the country. But it also means you need to find another backbencher who could take on the job of being party chairman. So
all right, well, I'll be talking to... Sorry, Gavin, I'll be talking to Junior Minister Neil Richmond in a moment. He might be disappointed that you didn't mention his name in terms of promotion.
Yeah, well, he certainly would be one of the more well-respected candidates within Fine Gael, and he does, I was about to sort of say it with a nod to the likes of The Tonight Show, but even the fact that he takes on invitations to come on programmes like yours as well. There are some people who always make a point of taking on the invitations because they reckon that when there is scope for promotion, they will be rewarded by party headquarters for doing so. I think the difficulty for Neil Richmond is if Peter Burke is already a shoe-in for one of them. Peter Burke is a curious creature because, you know, for those from Dublin, he would be seen as a culture because he's from Longford West Meath. But from those who are from Connacht or Munster, he'd be seen as too urbane because he's from Leinster. So he's neither culture enough for the Dubs nor Dub enough for the cultures. And therefore, Simon Harris would find himself under serious pressure to make sure that there's somebody else who is perceived as being rural or provincial. And that might argue against Neil Richmond when the time comes.
And as briefly as possible, please, what do you foresee for Helen McEntee is she safe in justice?
My gut is that she will probably be moved to a different role. I think that Simon Harris has come under so much pressure to relax some elements of the justice agenda, whether that be the overhaul of licensing laws or the pursuit of the laws against hate speech. I think he's just facing so much internal pressure to stand down on those that, were he to stand down on them, it's difficult to leave the minister responsible for pursuing them in situ. I certainly don't see her being demoted from cabinet. Mm-hmm. Maybe a move towards Simon's old job of higher education, perhaps. But okay. At this point, I would argue, I would perceive that she's not likely to remain in the justice portfolio, but will be still one of the six.
Okay, well, we'll find out next week. Gavin, thank you for joining us this morning. Gavin Riley, political correspondent with Virgin Media News.
Developing the national electricity grid so that it's fit for our current needs and ready for our future ones.
And now the aforementioned minister, that is the Minister for Business, Employment and Retail, Neil Richmond, joins us. Good morning, Minister. Thanks for your time. We're going to talk about grants for businesses to help them cope with the increasing cost of business in a moment. But Gavin Riley, a moment ago from Virgin Media News, saying that you're a good candidate for promotion next week. Are you hoping for a nod?
Look, that's a decision for Simon, and whatever decision he makes, I'm more than happy to row him behind. I very much like the job I'm in at the moment, but whatever way I can serve the party and, more importantly, the country, I'm game ball for that.
Okay. Pragmatic as always. Let's talk about these grants for businesses, predominantly for small and medium-sized businesses who could avail of grants of up to €5,000, isn't it?
Yeah, this is part of an overall package of €257 million that Simon Coveney announced in the budget. And registration opened for these a fortnight ago. So any business that paid commercial rates in Loudermead last year of up to €30,000 is eligible for these grants. And what we're making the appeal today is for businesses either to go onto the Mead County Council website or the Louth County Council website and to register. This isn't an arduous process. They literally just need to confirm their bank details. They need to confirm that the business is still trading, and if they paid commercial rates in 2023, they'll receive their grants in the next couple of weeks. So a business that paid over €10,000 on commercial rates will get a one-off grant of €5,000, and any business who paid under €10,000 will get 50% of the value of the commercial rates they paid in a grant. It's a small thing to go towards what are the rising costs of business, and so far we've seen over 20% of businesses in Mead and 17% of businesses in Louth have registered, but there's another 4 weeks to register, and we're making the appeal to all businesses. The sooner you register, the sooner we can put some money in your bank account.
Right. And as you say, it's a small measure. There's a lot of businesses who say that the market is so challenging at the moment that they need help. 41% increase in insolvencies, according to the PwC Insolvency Barometer, which was released just last week. The incoming Taoiseach, Simon Harris, has said that there may be more aid for businesses before the next budget. Do you know more about that, or what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so in the Department of Enterprise, we carried out a review of all the increased costs that have been impacting business, and we published that a few weeks ago, and it showed that the increased measures, and some of these are driven by outside factors, be they inflation or energy prices, but some of them are driven by government policy in terms of the increase of minimum wage, moving towards five statutory sick pay. Now, these are all things we want to do, but we recognise they come at a cost for employers. The report that we carried out showed that the vast majority, about 90% of employers, can take this on, no problem. But there is an acute amount of pressure on two particular sectors in terms of independent retail, smaller retail, and then the hospitality industry. So we released about €20 million in additional funds in the last fortnight to help those businesses to get more grant aid in relation to Green for Business. But absolutely, there is scope for us to do more, and there is a requirement for us to do more for those businesses in those areas. But the more tailored we can make those supports, the more they'll have an impact. So we're looking up at the various options. We'll discuss it a bit more at our desk this weekend. But Simon Harris has made it quite clear in his first speech in Athlone the other week at our selection convention that backing small business, particularly businesses outside Dublin, is his top priority for Sinn Féin in terms of the ministries that we hold. and that has to be done this side of the budget.
And business, small business in particular, concerned about the cost of automatic pension enrolment, has that led to the delay in enacting legislation?
No, in fairness, in getting the pension auto-enrollment scheme, there was a big announcement from Heather Humphreys last week on it. This is a tricky piece of work. This is going to be massive. It's going to bring so many people into the pension net that aren't covered at the moment. It is something that every business recognises that we need to do this. What we want to achieve in business is firstly that this is simple, it's straightforward, and that it isn't an onerous burden, be that on businesses or workers themselves. So we think we're close to having a system under Heather Humphreys that can deliver that. But again, this is yet another cost that will particularly impact smaller businesses, many of them in the hospitality and retail sector. So we need to have a package of supports that are based over the medium term. So it's not just something like these grants for the immediate, but something that we can bank in and work out for the next 3 to 5 years.
Okay, but you're with us this morning to remind businesses that there are these grants available to them of up to €5,000. You say it's straightforward and they can apply through their local authority website, Meath County Council website or Louth County Council website, and the grants will be paid in the coming weeks. Minister, thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today. That is the Minister for Business, Employment and Retail, Neil Richmond. Now, before we leave you this morning, let's go back to you and some of the comments that have been coming to us. Pat was in touch with us saying, what are all of these doctors complaining about? Does anyone want wages for a 39-hour week? I know when I go to the doctor, I have to pay €70 and I've never seen a poor doctor yet. Thanks, Pat, for your message. I think the doctors are concerned about having to work very long hours, 48 hours a week for 2 weeks in a row, which is in breach of the Working Time Act. And indeed, they're concerned about the decisions that they're making in hospitals. On cigarettes, we had somebody in touch with us about Benny Gilsonen, who we spoke to, saying that retailer is not the one suffering dreadful illness from smoking. They will never be too expensive. And we had Jerry Brady back in touch with us, who had been calling for cigarettes to be €20 a packet. And he says, the only one Benny is worried about, Michael, or the only thing he's worried about is his profits. He's the same every time that you have him on your show. Thanks for that, Jerry. And Paddy Duffy in touch with us saying, what I would remind Fine Gael of is that the Labour Party had 37 TDs after the election in 2011 and a few more than they have now. Unfortunately, the electorate has a long memory than, or longer memory than some politicians would like them to have. Thank you, Paddy, as always, for your text to the programme today. That has to be the final word. Chris Murray was under the control tower. I'm Michael, and God willing, we'll see you for our next programme tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
Listen back to the Michael Reid Show podcast on lmfm.ie or the LMFM app.
The Michael Reid Show with Airgrid, managing and developing the national electricity grid so that it's fit for our current needs and ready for our future ones.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.